We thought a good subject to cover in depth this year would be mobile television, and we did some of that this morning. We're going to do a lot of that this afternoon. Our next speaker seems to be everywhere. Everywhere I go around the country, I bump into him. So he's involved in everything that has to do with digital TV and now with mobile TV. Wayne Luplow is Vice President of HDTV Standards and Promotion for Zenith Corporation, a wholly owned subsidiary of LG Electronics. He's active in the Consumer Electronics Association and currently serves as Chairman of the Video Systems Engineering Committee, Chairman of the CEA Technology and Standards Council, and member of the Video Division Board. He also serves on the Board of Directors for the Advanced Television Systems Committee and the ATSC Forum. He was instrumental in Zenith's primary efforts for digital HDTV and the Grand Alliance, so he goes back at least that far and a lot further. He is a Life Fellow of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineering, IEEE. Earlier in his career, before joining Zenith, he was employed by RCA at the Dave Sarnoff Research Laboratories in Princeton, New Jersey. He's a native of the Badger State, a native of the Milwaukee, Wisconsin area, but now he and his wife live in Bear Country in Illinois. And he can't be perfect. Wayne Luplow.
Okay, can you hear me? Good, good. Well, I may be living in Bear Country, but I do have a cheese head, and I do have a Packer shirt and a Packer cap. So, and that's who we root for. Somebody asked me sometime who my favorite team is living in that area. We always say, well, we have two favorite teams, the Packers and anybody who beats the Bears. It is true. It's good to be back with you. I think what Len didn't say with that masterful introduction was that my undergraduate degree is from Madison here, 1962, by the way. But in any event, it's always good for us to come back here and be with this group. I was here, I think, 3 years ago, Len. I'm probably talking about DTV at that time. Today we're moving on. Transition is just about finished, hopefully just about finished, and where we go from here. And we believe that the way to go there is mobile handheld. My good friend Jerry Whitaker from ATSC kind of sets a little bit of a stage for us here relative to the work that's going on in the ATSC relative to standardizing a mobile handheld solution. And we're going to go into some of the details about that here in the next 45 minutes or so. I put on the slide here, parentheses LG, for those of you who do not know that. Zenith today is a wholly owned subsidiary of the giant consumer electronics company, LG, a Korean-based company. There is still a small portion of Zenith left, including the R&D activities, which I'm proud to be a part of and have been for, I'm just going to say, 40-plus years. So, again, it's good to be back here with you. Well, mobile handheld. I think the key word right off the bat is in-band. What we're talking about is using the broadcaster's existing 19.3 megahertz signal and adding to that supplementary signal, which will enable reach to a variety of products and services, handheld services, vehicle services. And what I didn't put on this slide and probably should have is laptops or tiny laptops, whatever we call laptops these days. And again, the key is, as you see in the lower left-hand corner, the in-home HD, SD remains the same. Consumers in the home still gets 8VSB DTV, and we take a piece of that channel, and I'll talk about how much we need to take as we go forward, and use that to deliver the ATSC MH signal. Here's a couple of examples of the type of products we're talking about, and again, I probably should have put a laptop on here that didn't. But we have done a lot of work and done some prototypes with devices that look something like this. Reception is very good. Performance is very good. I'll talk again about that as we move forward. There's a lot of interest on the part of the broadcast community in general, at least the broadcaster community that I play with, which is primarily network-based, group owner-based, chief engineer-based. And people say, you know, we want to have a technology that can deliver our signal to anyone, any place, any time, not just in front of in a home type of receiver. And the idea here is to deliver these services via your existing broadcast TV transmission system with a very minor change for that. I'm not going to talk too much about cost for converting, but the cost to convert to ATSC-MH is very trivial compared to the cost it was to convert from analog to digital. No new transmitter. Yes, a new exciter and some new encoding equipment things, but the cost is very small compared to the analog to digital conversion. We think this is an optimized mobile pedestrian handheld system. There was a competitive phase in the ATSC process, and during that competitive phase, we called our competitive system that came from LG, Zenith, and the Harris Corporation, we call that MPH. Since we're beyond the competitive phase now, we call it the ATSC-MH system. And I would just say if I slip back into the terminology MPH, it's because of everything I've done in terms of the competitive aspect. But now we're in a cooperative phase, and so I will try to use the terminology ATSC-MH. This is an embellishment of the ATSC standard. Same channel assignment. It's not a cellular approach, not like a Qualcomm approach with cells. No outside service providers are required. It's your signal. I mean, you do what you want with it. We don't have to have Verizon or an AT&T or a T-Mobile on the receiving end. We could choose to implement in a way where a common device would be a telephone, let's say, as well as a receiver for ATSC-MH. Don't have to pool your spectrum with the guy next door to you, but you could if you want to make a viable service for a handheld. If every broadcaster in a market wants to put on one, two, or three mobile type of programs, that just makes for the user a much larger selection of programs that he can receive in his mobile or handheld devices. The transmitted spectrum here, since this is an embellishment, is identical to the 8VSB transmission system. If you put a spectrum analyzer on it, or if the FCC puts a spectrum analyzer on it, they won't be able to tell the difference. We're not trying to fool anybody, but the spectrum is the same. And as my friend Jerry was saying, important here is 100% backward compatibility with all existing in-home ATSC receivers, those that are deployed and those that will continue to be deployed as we finish out the transition. And so that just effectively means that every receiver that's out there will continue to function just fine. The system is very flexible. They said it's a question of how much data you borrow from the 19.3 to use for mobile handheld type of considerations. We think the number of services is somewhere between 1 and 8. One service, you don't have to borrow very much. 8 services, you need to take a lot away from the 19.3. I mentioned the broadcaster interest, and Jerry also mentioned the Open Mobile Video Coalition. And a lot of companies have kind of banded together and said, we're interested in mobile. And they've been trying to drive this process. They've been trying to drive developers such as Zenith and LG to move forward on this. They've been trying to drive equipment manufacturers such as Rohde & Schwarz and Harris and others to move forward. They've been trying to drive the standard process forward within ATSC. So there's a lot of people involved in this. And these owners, these station groups, represent a lot of different stations around the country. And as such, unlike when we went from analog to digital, where I think a lot of the broadcasters kind of went in dragging their feet, and the FCC was yanking on everybody to make things happen. There seems to be a big push on the part of the broadcast community to be thinking about deployment of mobile handheld services. We think there's a bunch of urgency associated with moving to a mobile handheld operation. And I think, as perhaps you know better than I do, some of the advertising concerns or revenue drying up, can Nielsen measure everything that exists? The time for broadcasters to look for different revenue streams is certainly urgent. It's certainly now. Hence, we're trying to move this thing as forward as rapidly as possible. Commercial trials in 2009 we think are critical. We expect in maybe one or two major markets to get together with several different broadcast groups and have two or three stations on the air to try it from a commercial standpoint. Everything that's been done thus far has primarily been done on a show-and-tell coverage, technical type of basis, but we need to start taking a look at the commercial aspects of it as well. Because of this, and I mentioned that Harris and LG and Zenith feel that there is a sense of urgency and we're moving forward on that, but it's not just those companies that kind of invented the MPH system. It's other consumer and professional equipment manufacturers have also shown a lot of interest. And the candidate standard that Jerry was talking about enables other companies who weren't the primary developers here to work together to start making equipment so there can be competitive equipment both on the consumer side and on the professional side as well. LG, of course, is very important to LG. We're a large manufacturer of not just television sets, but mobile phones. So it's very synergistic with the type of products that we have. Our partner in the initial development, Harris, was very interested in this as they have a large market share in the U.S. And so we believe we're very close to being ready to deploy once we get some of these market trials behind us. Harris, having gotten a head start on this, has developed encoders, encapsulators, and multiplexers, which will be available this fall, at least so they tell us, which means just about any day now. Consumer product are coming. LG's prototype receivers exist. We've trialed them in a number of places, technical trials. We're on our second generation of chips, which I just heard came out of the foundry maybe last week. We're going to put those into additional prototype products come the CES show in Las Vegas in January. The ATSC process, and Jerry didn't mention it, but when you have an ATSC standard or any type of a standard, you're required to do open licensing, open and equal licensing. And so it isn't that somebody who owns a lot of the technology can kick other people out of the marketplace. It says if you're part of an ATSC standard, you have to agree to license everyone on a fair and equitable basis. And that makes for the competitive nature of this whole process, which is good for everybody. We talked about backwards compatibility, and so compatibility becomes an important consideration. The transmission system or the physical layer is compatible, as I said before, with 8VSB, same transmitter, no additional transmitter power. The error correction stuff for 8VSB, nothing changes. And as I said before, the spectrum is identical. In the transport realm, that's also compatible with the main service. Distributed transmissions or single frequency networks are also entirely possible with this in the areas where SFNs are considered necessary. We don't know where that is yet. We don't think it's going to, I personally don't think it's going to be a whole lot. What did I do here? Too many thumbs. Let's talk about some of the features or characteristics. The physical layer has very high immunity to dropouts and burst noise. There is no need for receiver antenna diversity. Having a handheld device about this big, diversity makes no sense whatsoever because you can't get enough spacing between the antennas. Conceivably, in a vehicle with a front-mounted and a back-mounted receiving antenna, you could get some benefit from diversity. We don't think it's necessary. All the tests that have been done don't show that it doesn't need to be necessary. The system provides up to 11.5 dB gain in terms of threshold, meaning instead of the threshold being the signal-to-noise required being the familiar 15 dB, it can be as low as 4.5 dB, and you still have very good reception with the mobile equipment. And it's got to be high speed as well. We think handheld devices, pedestrian, we think vehicles like cars, but we also think handheld devices in trains, hence the design for fast speeds. The system is very flexible and data efficient. Now, I'm giving a couple of examples here. I think there was some discussion about how much data is required to provide what kind of services. An example would be if one takes 1.8 megabits from the main 19.3 stream, you could deliver one service of 630 kilobits. Very good type of a 630 kilobits will give a very good video type of program on any reasonable size screen. 50-inch screen, no. 7-inch screen, 10-inch like a laptop, or smaller like handheld devices, very, very good pictures. Some of the examples that we've used in recent tests and demonstrations, we've taken 4.4 megabits away from the 19.3 and provided two different video programs, one with a lower bit rate and one with a slightly higher bit rate into the handheld devices. The minimum data that one would take, could take, is 130 kilobits. Well, what kind of video can you do with that? You can't. But it shows you could do an audio service, too, if you wanted with the system. The maximum that you can take away from the 19 megabits is 14.7. Doesn't leave a whole lot, but it does leave a program for somebody who's doing an SD program. And when you do that, you have the opportunity for as many as 8 different programs in the mobile handheld receivers. The coding and the channel coding is scalable. We talk about a half rate code and a quarter rate code and some codes in between, and it just says depending upon the terrain and the towers and what have you, one can adjust the system. One of the concerns in handheld devices with video is power consumption, a finite battery life with the handheld receivers. And the system is designed to effectively, if you have couple different programs, let's say, being transmitted. Of course, you can only watch one at a time in the receiver. Good portion of the receiver can be turned off for the second program that's not being watched so that the processing power goes down with the idea of extending the battery life associated with it. With the computer age and compatibility with computers and other technologies, the system coming out of ATSC is Internet Protocol based. This supports stream and non-real-time delivery. Again, Jerry was talking about some of that. The system uses the pretty familiar nowadays, a more aggressive video coding system, H.264, MPEG-4, other terminology for that, and an audio coding system that's called AAC-HE. I said before, each RF channel is capable of delivering up to 8 mobile programs, up to 630 kilobits, and still maintain a minimal program in the mainstream going to the home. Remember that the only requirement that you have on the part of the FCC is to deliver one digital program comparable in quality to NTSC quality, and that's easily done with 5 megabits. I'm not saying you want to do that much, I'm just pointing to the flexibility. Some people use the term electronic service guide. That's the same as EPG, electronic program guide. The terminology has changed a little bit to recognize that we get more than just programs these days. We get services, which can be data casting, banner advertising. All of these things are possible. Bits are bits. They can flow through the mobile handheld channel just as well. Been a lot of talk about public safety applications, things like Katrina and other events that become emergency sort of situations. This type of service to be used with battery operation anywhere, any place, any type of device, and be received extremely robustly, we think is just what's going to be needed for emergency kinds of situations, hopefully not as big as 9/11 or Katrina, but in other types of power outage emergency considerations. We've done a lot of testing in a bunch of different cities, both in this country and around the world, actually South, when I say around the world, South America and Mexico, with a variety of different channels. Including some high VHF channels. The system works quite well on high V. Low V, because of antennas about this big, is extremely doubtful. It's the reality of the physics that we face, and I hope that none of you are going to have digital channels in low V because it's going to be difficult for mobile. But I think there's, in the U.S., there's something like 40 stations that will have low V, I think, out of the 1,600 or so stations. Don't quote me on the numbers, but I think that's what it is. What we've seen in all of these tests is that the coverage area achieved with a handheld device about this big, that coverage area is equal to, is a, perhaps a way to say that, to what you get with a digital channel, with a digital 8 VSB signal. You're farther, the distance from the transmitter is the same. The lower threshold buys you what you lose by this with a small antenna. So the fact that the threshold is much lower, you can receive about the same distance. Virtually all of the tests have shown where you get 8 VSB in a stationary environment. In that same location, you get the MH signal reception equally well. Obviously, it has a threshold effect, just like the digital channels do. Jerry also mentioned the IDOV testing that came out of the OMVC group. They did this for the ATSC. It was independent testing. The tests I mentioned on the previous slide were tests that Zenith LG and Harris did to develop the system, to fine-tune the system, to show that it really works. But, of course, people in the standards business and broadcasters want to have some sort of an independent look at it. So we handed over the equipment, and they kicked the tires. And at that time, of course, it was a competitive system. So that's why I call it the MPH system, but it's the MPH system that has now become the ATSC MH system, but it was MPH that was tested. We were able to put this system on the air in three different channels in each of two different locations, one San Francisco, San Jose area, and the second in Las Vegas. Had a competitive test. The purpose of the test was twofold as far as the broadcasters were concerned. One is to see if one system was better than the other systems. But the other thing that was very important to them, that the claims that we made with respect to the coverage and did it really work well, that is the primary purpose of what they did the IDOF testing for. And they actually found that the two systems that provided hardware and that were tested actually worked quite well, but they had to make a choice between the one that was A and A minus, or however you define it, and they did make that choice. They also did some laboratory testing, mostly on the basis of backwards compatibility with a whole bunch of receivers, and they did that at the Communications Research Center of Canada in Ottawa. The two physical layer systems that were tested were the MPH system that I've been talking about, which is moving forward, and then a system called AVSB that was provided by Samsung and Rohde & Schwarz. The results that came out of that test showed the OTAG is the technical group of the OMVC, and they came away with the conclusion that that the most viable system was the MPH system. So that's what's moving forward in the ATSC standardization process. Now, at the same time, or about the same time, LG and Samsung, both large Korean companies, got their heads together, and they agreed to join forces with the system that the OTAG people found was the better of the two, and moving forward together on the MPH system, which, again, is now called ATSC-MH. As Jerry said, the ATSC technical group has completed the system on it. There is a working draft, and that draft is going to has gone to ballot. Ballot came out on Monday of this week, and 6 weeks from now, we expect that we'll have the results of that ballot. If two-thirds of those people who vote on this agree that this is a good candidate standard, we will have a candidate standard in the six-week time period. Okay, what do we have to do to get to commercialization? The 2009 CES, January, Las Vegas. What we're going to show there is the first demonstration of a complete system. We have shown physical layer types of demonstrations at CES and NAB for some period of time now, but the additional work that's been going on within ATSC deals with the management layer, deals with the video compression, deals with the audio compression, and all of these things together will come together for the first time in the type of demonstrations that will take place at CES Las Vegas in January. This will then be, if you like, embellished further in terms of some bells and whistles, and that's what you'll see at the NAB show in Vegas in the spring. After NAB 2009, we expect that the standard will become first a proposed standard and then a final standard. If you remember the chart that Jerry showed with the progressive ellipses on it, that's the process that the standard will go through. So we're going to be doing some market field trials, working with broadcasters to develop business models. How do you make money out of this thing? It's a technology, but it has to flow to the bottom line. It doesn't cost much to get into the business, but still people want to make money with the technology that they have. And pretty soon you'll start seeing first real consumer products in the marketplace. What we've been talking about now is what I would call prototypes. We have developed various types of form factors for the received devices. I mentioned laptops, automobile-based kinds of things, rear seat sorts of devices, little larger screens. You could talk about a 5-inch GPS device that might have GPS and have ATSC-MH signal in it, mobile phone size. This is kind of the thing that we look at as what's going to be in the marketplace. This is just some bigger pictures of the same kind of things that I'm talking about. One company we've worked with is Kenwood that makes aftermarket video systems for vehicles. They've taken the technology and incorporated it into some of their equipment. Again, rear seat type of equipment. That's the 5-inch device. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about maybe what's most important to you is what do you have to do on the station side? What do you have to do to implement? And try to give pretty much of an overview over of that. Well, here's a block diagram. One of the important things to recognize is that even though you have mobile signals, it's still only one STL between the transmitter and the studio. It's the existing STL. When you start looking here, you see, well, fine, you have to have a multiplexer. You have that today. You need a main channel encoder or coders on the left side. And, of course, you have to have mobile channel encoders as well. Again, that's MPEG-4, as I said before, for the video. That gets encapsulated with Internet Protocol and through the multiplexer and onto the exciter. On the bottom, I showed in an optional area here service and content protection. Read that as pay type of services or at least opportunity for getting information back to the broadcaster in terms of who's watching, some feedback on that. Don't need that to start. Some broadcasters have expressed a lot of interest in having pay services. I think the startup will not be pay just because we don't have the wherewithal to make that happen at zero time. But the point is that the service is flexible. It can be pay services, and some broadcasters may wish pay services, and others are talking about free-to-air services. And it can be either or some combination thereof. I'm going to go a little bit with some of the functions of the various parts in that block diagram. One is the encoder. I talked about the video. The resolution that's part of the ATSC standard is 416 by 240 widescreen aspect ratio. The source for this video could be anything else that's down-converted to this scanning standard. And, of course, we have to include closed captioning in terms of what we do for the community, those who need closed captioning. Audio is a Dolby-based system, HEAAC. There's some sample frequencies. Can be stereo or mono or what is called parametric surround. It's a way of making surround sound really out of two channels. The output of the encoder is a packetized IP. Most of this is like computer terminology or DVB type of terminology where some standards have been developed. I'm not going to go into the nuts and bolts of that. The encapsulator takes IP data from the encoders and non-real-time services and service protection, if any, and puts this all into an IP stream. The input is can be IP over what's called UDP, can be Ethernet as well. The output is MPEG-2 transport stream because that's what the ATSC 8VSB system requires. Let's see. Need a multiplexer. I showed that on the chart. Need to put all this stuff together. The inputs can be SMPTE 310, ASI ports for the output, ASI for the input, and the output is SMPTE 310. Now, this is the way we have implemented the first configurations here. There may be other ways, and how this is, the pieces are put together is really up to the individual equipment supplier or the broadcaster who's buying from that particular supplier. What I've really been showing with the block diagram and talking about these parts is one way of putting the pieces together. It's not the only way. Obviously, one needs to have operation and maintenance control of how this happens, and so you need a device that does this. It's part of a normal station type of control. And then, of course, there's the exciter, which will generate the 8VSB main service while at the same time processing the MH, ATSC MH signal. One exciter per transmitter is all required. So effectively, the big cost, if you like, and it isn't that big, is a swap out of the exciter and then some of the encoding encapsulation for the mobile portion back at the studio. I said electronic service guide before. If we have multiple type of programs that are in a handheld device or a in-vehicle device, clearly this day and age, having some sort of an electronic program guide or service guide is desirable. You guys know about program guides, and just put some examples of that in here. You can have a basic program guide, you can have detailed program information, and you'll start to see some examples of this as we start going down the deployment path, and some of the early prototype equipment will contain this capability. Type of information, news information can be part of this. We think compelling applications such as news, weather, sports, tickers, traffic, these are kind of things which are important in the local market. This is not a national service, although it could take a national feed. It's what any local broadcaster, each local broadcaster thinks is compelling service to their customers. Lots of different types of datacast applications. I'm not going to go through that, but I think, as you all know, delivering data for somebody else using your bandwidth is potentially a very good bottom line kind of operation for you. This is the pay service that I talked about, whether not necessary, but in some cases people will insist upon having to pay services. The pay service has the usual problem of there needs to be some sort of a back channel or a return channel to collect the information. There's a number of different ways of doing it. If you go to bed with a Verizon or somebody like that, obviously you got to pay them for something or other, but then you do have a back channel via the cellular phone sort of a situation. One can consider a back channel by porting the output of the handheld device into any type of a internet type of application. These things have not been worked out yet. There's going to be a lot of discussion and ideas on this going forward, which is why I said I don't believe the first applications or the first deployment will be pay type of services. Kind of in a wind-up here, the MH system has been designed specifically for broadcaster needs. It's not designed for cable or satellite or anything else, or nothing special like the flow system. It's for broadcasters' needs. Just take the broadcaster equipment and broadcaster signal and use that to provide additional money-making services to the consumer. Audience measurement, we're going to have to figure out how to do that. As I said, there's different ways of doing it. Lots of flexibility in terms of what you transmit, lots of flexibility in terms of the form factor of the receive type of device. Lots of competitors are going to be in this marketplace because the broadcasters are pushing so hard, the equipment manufacturers are running pretty rapidly to figure out how they're going to make that equipment. And when that happens, the receiver guys are saying, whoa, I think there's a marketplace here, and so you're going to start to see a lot of competition on the receive side as well. A lot of this is being driven by the broadcasters total as broadcasters, individual groups, or through the OMVC, and then the ATSC is cracking the whip on terms of getting the standard done. So we're moving rapidly towards standardization and implementation. With that, I'm going to say thank you, and I don't know how we're doing on time here. Do we have time for questions?
Yeah, we got about 6 minutes, and I have the first two.
The first 2 minutes or the first two questions, Len?
I noticed that in your slide that had to do with the eight program streams, it looked like in a rough calculation that was quarter rate encoding, correct?
That one probably was half rate coding because the half rate, of course, is more efficient. It's a trade-off. If you want quarter rate coding, okay, you effectively have to take more bits to do protection, to do encoding, and you deliver less bits.
Right. And what all the tests that were done by the IDOV, what was that? Did they do both rates?
The IDOV tests did quarter rate only in terms of what IDOV did. The vast majority of the tests that we have done, we did one of the programs in half rate and one in quarter rate, so that we learned the difference in performance and receivability between the quarter and the half. And in most cases, I believe that half rate is going to be quite sufficient, but IDOV was ringing it out to get the maximum capability out of the system.
Okay. And quickly, when you started this whole process at LG, you were partnered with Harris. Does that partnership still exist, or did that go away?
Well, we've worked together with Harris because clearly one needed somebody on the transmit side to produce the transmitter equipment, the prototype type of equipment. And yes, we still do have a close relationship with Harris, but we've also started a program where we're working with all of the U.S. transmitter makers to share information to try to get them up to speed. From an LG standpoint, it makes sense to have competition because for broadcasters to take it up, you're going to want to have competition for price reasons and just competition. And every broadcaster typically has their favorite vendor or their historical vendor. So for us to help other guys move forward and get started, we are doing that in parallel with work that's going on at the same time with Harris. We needed somebody to help us get the show on the road in the competitive phase, and so now we're working more evenly with other broadcasters as well.
If the stream is SMPTE 310M compatible, why do we need a different exciter, a new exciter?
Well, the exciter has to do the additional encoding, the additional channel coding, the physical layer coding for the mobile handheld signal. It's a different coding scheme. I believe that what you can expect out of exciter manufacturers is that here's an exciter that by adding cards or dongles or, you know, a peripheral piece of equipment, it will or will not do MH kind of encoding as well. And when I say encoding here, I'm talking about channel coding, not video coding.
Understand. While on that subject, Kevin brings up a good point. If this is not, even though it is the same, something in there has got to be different. So should we keep calling it 310 or should we call it 310A or Rev2 or something? The reason why I'm asking is that my employer, we've discussed some of this, and we're actually buying an auxiliary digital transmitter as we speak, and it's going to have the latest and greatest exciters from Thomson. And those exciters will be, of course, easily upgraded to the MH standard. But at the same time, I would have to put a new exciter in my main DTV transmitter. What I'm trying to get at is, if I take the new, I'll just call it SMPTE 310A for lack of a better term, and I stick that into my older traditional 8VSB exciter, will I still get my conventional 8VSB functionality? Because buying two exciters at once is going to choke a lot of budgets, is what I'm saying. Okay, I understand you don't have to change anything past the exciter, but to swallow, you know, especially for smaller market broadcasters, to buy two exciters at once may be daunting, and the boss might say, well, buy one this year and buy one next year.
Well, I'm not sure we're... See, I'm searching for the...
You know
right
where I'm going.
Slide. Well, no, I don't know where you're going with it, because there is one exciter required to do both. Okay?
I understand that.
The existing exciter today will not do both. Okay, can there be an embellishment to the existing exciter that would add MH? I don't know the answer to that. You'll have to talk to your transmitter
exciter.
That's not
the question I'm asking. The question I'm asking is, this new SMPTE-310, the new version, stuck into an old exciter, will the old exciter still give me my traditional ATSE output, or will it choke?
I don't believe it will choke.
Okay.
But you really want to talk to some exciter manufacturer. I see Mike here from Rohde. Do you know the answer to that question?
Okay. All right, go on. I got a couple more.
He's an exciter guy. I'm more of a receiver guy.
By very nature of being backward compatible, and I think as Wayne said, he would argue with you to take a spectrum analyzer or any piece of test equipment and try to identify there's something different here. There's no difference. It would pass straight through. Right. No problem. I mean, you're serving normal viewers all the time. It's just a percentage of mix between mobile and normal. You could take normal up to 100%. And everything will be fine.
I'm going to get out of the transmitter and go to the receivers. Okay. The way I understand it is that this is developed as an MH standard, low bandwidth, small pictures, low quality. At one time, we were talking about enhancing ATSC for signals in bad reception areas, like a Barker audio to let you know, you've got, say, channel 3.0. You can't get a picture today. Are some of these enhancements going to fall into the traditional receivers and set-top boxes, or is this locked in exclusively towards the mobile handheld hardware? Because I see some of the enhancements being beneficial in some home receiver environments that are difficult.
Okay, good question. The existing receivers that are deployed today that you have in your home, sort of a thing, will get no benefit from this system, okay? Once this system is deployed and receivable in handheld vehicular type of devices, will receiver manufacturers provide an MH receiving capability as an embellishment in the television set? Probably, okay. I mean, with any receiver manufacturer, is there business there? Is there a benefit to it? If you do, and if some will certainly do it, okay, that just says you will have the more robust capability, the fallback kind of a thing that you're looking for. But ATSC standard is an emission standard. It does not tell manufacturers they must put something in a television set. But, where there's business, people flock.
Okay, Wayne, I hope I don't misstate here, but I think maybe some of the confusion is the SMPTE 310 is just the transport standard.
I think it is. I believe
so
that's what it is.
It doesn't have anything to do with what's in the bits in that transport. It's just to get it from the studio to the transmitter.
That's correct. 310. That's
when
correct.
When it leaves the ATSC transmitter, it's not 310 anymore. It's 8VSB.
Correct. It's like saying it's an Ethernet connection,
right?
Audio connection. It's
so the
coax.
Receiving the box on the other end has to know what the bits are to know what to do with them.
Exactly. It says it's plug compatible. Effectively, is what it means.
Any more questions? All right. Oh, we do have one more. Hang on.
How much emphasis is being put into the radio aspects of the chipsets that you're working on right now? I can't help but connect the two dots that this may be a killer application for radio.
Audio only type services?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't really have to do anything in the receiver, okay, because the audio can be, if the broadcaster wants to put pick a number, 48 kilobits in for an audio service and nothing for a video service. And since the handheld device has audio and video services, it's there, it's done, okay. The question becomes, does a television broadcaster want to use his bandwidth or very much of his bandwidth for an audio-only service? Probably some will do it because it's pretty easy to do. Pick a number, 48 kilobits doesn't take a whole lot out of 19.3.
Okay, thank you, Wayne. Very good discussion.
You want, are you all set up? Or are you...